Iran's president warns Iranians of a big cost if they revive mass protests to mark this week's first anniversary of the death in custody of women's rights icon Mahsa Amini. We ask a human rights group why Tehran is carrying out preemptive arrests nationwide.
We see a regime that is quite fearful of what may unfold as we approach the anniversary.
Plus, Iran is building up its forces in Syria. The American Enterprise Institute tells us why those deployments are crucial for Tehran.
The Iranians very much so look at Syria as a very integral component to their so-called axis of resistance.
And after U.S. researchers and journalists uncover new details of a Russian factory making Iranian-designed attack drones, we ask how the world is responding. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Iran. Good morning. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi has issued a defiant message to Iranians who plan to engage in acts of protests marking the anniversary of Mahsa Amini's death in police custody on September 16th last year. Amini was a 22-year-old Iranian Kurdish woman who was detained for allegedly not wearing her hijab in accordance with Islamist dress codes. In a rare interview with a Western news organization that was published Tuesday, Raisi told a reporter for U.S. network NBC in Tehran that he is ready to listen to what protesters have to say on any issue. But he followed that assertion with a warning that people who, as he put it, abuse Amini's name to create instability in the country at the behest of foreign powers will pay a big cost. U.S. State Department spokesman Matthew Miller responded to Raisi's warning at a Tuesday press briefing.
I will say those comments are particularly offensive coming when they do the week of the anniversary of the protests last year, the one-year anniversary. And I will say that we will continue to support the Iranian people at the height of the protests last year when we were providing internet access to the Iranian people when it had been shut down by the Iranian government. As many as 1 in 3 Iranians used U.S.-supported anti-censorship and digital security tools. We held accountable those responsible for Mahsa Amini's death, and we will continue to do so. And I would call on the Iranian government to respect the rights and wishes of its citizens and not stifle their voices.
Skylar Thompson is the director of global advocacy for human rights activists in Iran, a U.S.-based nonprofit group. It has a network of activists inside Iran who raise awareness about rights abuses in the country. I spoke to Thompson by phone Tuesday to ask what she has observed as Iran cracks down on peaceful dissent ahead of this week's anniversary.
So I think it's really clear that these sort of crackdowns on activists in particular are taking a really preemptive form. I think, you know, it really mirrors what we saw in September of last year when we saw reports of authorities entering the homes of women human rights activists and others and, you know, apprehending them, what was seemingly out of a fear that they might take a leadership role in the unrest that was unfolding. And I think that's what we're seeing, you know, in the last several weeks. We saw it, I think it was noted on September 9th, VOA actually published a report in southwest Iran. We've seen it in Sistan and Balochistan. We saw it in Gilan. You know, it's a really sort of widespread, and it's really alarming. These individuals have not committed any crimes. They're being accused of outlandish things, colluding with foreign agencies and all of these other things that are unfounded. There's no evidence that goes along with these claims. And like I said, I think they really mirror what we saw at the outset of the protests last year.
Well, given that these repressive measures seem awfully familiar, why do you think Iran is using them again? Is it because these tactics work for them?
You know, I think what it alludes to is that we see a regime that is quite fearful of what may unfold as we approach the anniversary of the death in detention of Mahsa Amini and the outbreak of the Women Life Freedom protests. I think they are quite fearful of what might happen. I mean, it's not only the arrest of activists. We've seen quite alarming number of students summoned in schools. Thousands of students have been summoned in schools and forced to essentially promise that they will not participate in protest-related activity. We've spoken to several students that have discussed being essentially forced to sign contracts, so to say, that they will not participate in this type of activity. We've seen several faculty members dismissed and replaced with faculty that maybe we might say are more aligned with the regime. So it's really widespread. It's sort of reaching across all sectors of society.
So another element of this crackdown, as Hirana has been reporting, is the government's efforts to tighten the enforcement of the mandatory hijab for women in public through this legislation that's working its way through Parliament. What can you tell our listeners about where this legislation stands and when we might see it actually implemented?
Yeah, so as you mentioned, we have seen this crackdown manifest in the introduction of this new hijab bill. We've been hearing about this new hijab bill in a number of ways for several months now. And on purpose, at the hands of the regime, it's been quite vague. You know, everyone has been asking a lot of questions about what does it entail, where does it stand, and make no mistake that that has been done on purpose. But right now, we know that this bill has expanded from its original 15 articles to include 70 highly contentious articles that truly evade on every single sector of society and really allow for the regime to enter the private lives of women through the use of technology.
Can you give some examples?
Yes, sure. So for example, the bill will allow for the use of technology in a way that creates a lot of right to privacy concerns. The legislation will allow for the use of CCTV cameras to monitor the mandatory hijab compliance in the country. Already, we've seen judges use this as evidence in trials, which is, you know, really alarming. There are a lot of issues with using this type of evidence. And what we also see in the legislation is the mandating of entities across the country to implement the legislation. So what this means is that not only will we see the judiciary taking action, we'll see the Ministry of Youth and Sport being compelled to report. We'll see ministries elsewhere being compelled to report. And this really evades on every sector of society and creates a large concern.
When you consider the arrests and home raids that you mentioned and the government pushing through this hijab bill in the coming months, how do you think this is affecting the mood of the activist community in Iran, relatives of victims of past protests who want to mark this anniversary in some way? Is it demoralizing them, what's going on, or are they still, do you think, going to come out and do something for this anniversary?
It's a really good question. I think we can be certain that these attempts are not demoralizing citizens of Iran. I mean, Iranian women have told us that they will continue the fight despite the government's futile attempts to silence them. And I think that this is also seen throughout time. You know, the Women Life Freedom protests were a symbol of that very thing. Mahsa Amini, her death was a symbol of the authorities in the Iranian regime trying to silence women. And women came to the streets and they stood up and they demanded that their voices were heard. And they're still doing that today. And I don't believe that these preemptive arrests that are being made out of a fear of a return to the street or what have you are going to do that.
Well, Skylar Thompson, Director of Global Advocacy for the U.S. nonprofit group Human Rights Activists in Iran, or Hirana, on the line from the Washington, D.C. area. Great to have you back on Flashpoint Iran.
Thanks so much, Michael. Thanks for having me.
Iranian forces and their proxies in Syria appear to be on the move again. The Washington-based American Enterprise Institute says Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps, or IRGC, redeployed hundreds of Iranian allied militants from Syria's east to its northwest region last week. AEI said the redeployment is likely part of Iran's effort to combat militants that pose a threat to Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, a key Iranian ally. Nicholas Carl has been monitoring Iranian force movements in Syria for AEI's Critical Threats Project. I asked him by phone why Tehran has put so many military resources into Syria in recent months.
The Iranians very much so look at Syria as a very integral component to their so-called axis of resistance. And this term, axis of resistance, is the one that Iranian leaders will use frequently themselves to refer to their international coalition of state, semi-state, and non-state actors. And so, of course, you know, various members of this axis include Lebanese Hezbollah, the Houthi movement in Yemen, and all sorts of other Bahraini, Iraqi, Syrian, and Palestinian militias. So, as I mentioned, Assad is a vital component of this axis. He is one of the few state actors that is explicitly aligned with Iran. So, of course, the Iranians are not only interested in Syria because they believe that they can derive all sorts of economic and political advantages from having a close cooperative relationship with the Assad regime. They also sort of view Syria as kind of the connective tissue across a lot of their axis of resistance, right? It is one of the principal routes through which they are able to provide various kinds of military and logistical support to Hezbollah in Lebanon, or various Palestinian groups active throughout the West Bank. So Iran has a real strategic interest in Syria as one of the principal methods by which it can sort of build up the military presence of its axis of resistance around Israel's periphery.
And so why is it important for Iran to have a presence in the eastern and southern parts of Syria specifically? How do those regions give Iran the advantage that it seeks?
Great question. So in the context of the southern part of Syria, that one's sort of the most straightforward. That is the area that is closest to Israel. And so that is the area around which Iran has spent a considerable amount of time building up its military presence, trying to entrench itself there, storing various sophisticated military capabilities like drones and such. So southern Syria, in addition to that strategic significance, also is important to Iran because it's the capital, right? That's where Assad is. You know, Damascus is located in the south of the country. And so part of all of this Iranian effort in Syria includes trying to stabilize the Assad regime. And so to that end, they just have, you know, historically had a lot of military capability and capacity around this area. The eastern part of the country is a bit more interesting in this regard. This is the part that borders Iraq. And so, you know, the Iranians have long dreamt of this sort of contiguous ground route that connects Iran to Lebanon through Iraq and Syria. So, you know, one of the main border crossings between Iraq and Syria is in the eastern part of the country, in Deir ez-Zor province. And so, you know, you can see a huge presence of Iranian forces there. And that has been the case largely since they began to seriously push out ISIS from the area back in 2017. I say push out. ISIS continues to have a very active presence in this part of the country, but they don't control territory in the same way that they used to back in 2017.
When you talk about seeing Iranian forces and their proxies on the ground, and you and your colleagues are not on the ground yourselves, so how are you able to see that? You know, what are your sources and how do you verify the information you're getting from the sources regarding the armed presence on the ground?
Yeah, to be sure, it is a significant undertaking that requires a great deal of attention and rigor. And my team continues to execute it day by day with a really high degree of sophistication, for which I'm very grateful. So the short of it is that we employ a set of analytical tradecraft practices to best understand the Syrian information space and try to provide our readers the most accurate depiction of what is going on in Syria possible. Of course, you know, as I'm sure you and many of your listeners already know, you know, the Syrian information space is absolutely rife with misinformation and, you know, all sorts of rumors that are difficult to corroborate. So, you know, we spend a lot of time trying to understand the sources that we are using. We rely exclusively on information that is available publicly, right? So we have no sources on the ground ourselves. We are instead looking at media outlets both, you know, local opposition sources as well as state-run media. We look at commercially available satellite imagery or social media posts.
So that means you have to have some knowledge of Arabic, don't you, to understand the language that these messages are posted in and articles are written in?
Indeed, and not just Arabic. Persian, Turkish, Kurdish, you know, all sorts of different languages, you know, become pretty significant here. And we are constantly building out internally evaluations of these sources to try and understand, you know, what are these sources? Because, you know, they're also sometimes actors that are active within the space, influencing it to their own degree. So, you know, we're constantly trying to build out our understanding of these sources, trying to look at their access, their bias, their reliability. And that ultimately informs what confidence we assign to the information that we are seeing. So that's a continual challenge that the team tries to work through. But it's also just part of open source intelligence.
Right. That's open source intelligence. But are you able to actually communicate directly with any of the players in Syria themselves?
As a matter of policy, we do not. So we are not engaging privately with anyone who has a presence in Syria or anything to that effect.
And why is that?
Well, you know, we go to great lengths to demonstrate our reputability to the analytical community. When we publish articles and products, what we are trying to do is not say to our readers, hey, just trust us. We know this information via private sources, and therefore, you know, you just got to believe us. Instead, what we do is we meticulously cite from open source reporting everything that we are seeing. So that way, our readers can look at our homework, grade our work. They can look to see how it is that we are getting our information, from where we're getting our information, and they have the freedom to try to understand it themselves as best they can. So we try to offer, to the best extent we can, our own personal interpretation of what is going on the ground, but we're trying to ultimately demonstrate the utility of open source information. It's a tremendously important resource that the U.S. intelligence community and analytical community has not yet harnessed, I think, to its full potential. And so that's part of what we're trying to do here, demonstrate the utility in a lot of this information.
So another thing that you monitor is the U.S. forces that are on the ground in Syria and their allies. How do they fit into the picture of what Iran is doing in Syria?
Yeah. So I mentioned earlier that one of the most important Iranian objectives in Syria is trying to preserve the Assad regime. There's another important strategic objective to which the Iranians assign a lot of urgency and importance that we've not yet really discussed. And that is the longstanding Iranian effort to expel all American influence and military forces from the Middle East. Iranian leaders have been extraordinarily explicit in that they want to ultimately get rid of all U.S. forces in Iraq and Syria. And so, of course, you know, for those reasons, Syria is one of the principal theaters in which we see this Iranian campaign against the United States materialize. So, you know, the Iranians are constantly employing various tools at their disposal as a means of trying to create and foster an increasingly hostile operating environment for U.S. forces there.
And how successful would you say they're being in that objective?
Well, you know, of course, we remain there at the moment, but to be sure, they are continually building up various kinds of military forces around our bases in Syria as a means of really trying to squeeze us and coerce us as much as they possibly can. You know, of course, the purpose of U.S. forces in Syria remains securing the enduring defeat of the Islamic State. That is the reason why we have a limited contingent of forces on the ground there. And, you know, the Iranians are trying their best to prevent us from being able to operate effectively within the environment. They are instead trying to increase the threat that their own forces pose to our service members deployed there on the ground. The calculus here, from Tehran's perspective, is ultimately that U.S. policymakers will decide to pull out from Syria because they just don't any longer see the value in having a force presence there. So, of course, we remain there for the moment. You know, what that's going to look like in the years ahead, of course, remains uncertain. And I'm not really prepared to guess what that might be.
Nicholas Carl, Middle East Portfolio Manager for the Critical Threats Project at the American Enterprise Institute, joining us on the line from here in Washington, D.C. Nice of you to be with us on Flashpoint Iran.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Iran. I'm Michael Lippin. Last week, we brought you the first part of my interview with a U.S. research group that joined the Washington Post in analyzing documents apparently leaked from a Russian facility producing attack drones designed by Iran. The Washington-based Institute for Science and International Security studied the documents and said they appear to be authentic materials from the facility in Russia's Alabuga Special Economic Zone. In part two of my conversation with ISIS President David Albright, I asked what impact he has seen from his findings that the facility relies heavily on Western electronic components to make the drones.
Well, we've seen a lot of interest. I mean, we're dealing mostly with governments. I mean, we're holding back a lot of our publications on this and reaching out to governments, and we'll move forward on that.
When you talk about interest, do you mean that there are governments who are telling you that this reporting is going to influence them in some way in terms of trying to, let's say, restrict the types of electronic products that Russia can get a hold of that they could use at Alabuga?
Yeah, yes. I think that's a short answer. I mean, everyone's trying to figure out what is best to control and how do you do it. And what these documents have, at least one looking at it now, been working on it today, is a complete part list for the Shahed 136 drone provided by Iran to Alabuga. And then Alabuga breaks it down into much more detail. So you know, if you want a Texas Instrument part, they're writing down the exact part number for that. And it's organized by the components in the drone. Now, this is minus the motor. The motor's a separate process of Iran initially supplies, and then they're learning to make. But on these electronic systems, it's very specific. And yeah, people have been finding these things in downed drones. But here you have Iran's take on what they do to build the various components. And even down to these connectors. I mean, it's now in the news about connectors because of some blowing up in Iran, but you see the exact connectors that are needed for the Shahed 136. There's about 40 of them.
So when it comes to all these different parts, what kind of steps do you anticipate in the coming weeks and months from governments, from businesses to try to prevent the Iranians and Russians from getting those parts?
Yeah, you know, one is just better understanding what parts they're seeking. You know, they're looking to maximize the parts they need to get to increase the chance of success, because so many of them are Western, and particularly U.S. parts. And so the bottom line is that we now know, have a very particular, exact sense of what goes into their systems, and that's helpful to understand what to control. Now, that's the only one step, and it's adding to what's already known from the analysis of downed drones. It also, one of the things the documents does is that, yes, I may agree with you, the schedule may be ambitious, but it shows that we better act now, because they want to finish this project by, let's say, September 2025 and have 6,000 drones and the ability to make 6,000 more. And so on the battlefield, you'd go from tens of Shahed 136 type drones attacking to hundreds. And so the time to act is now. And the electronics industry has not really been subject to the practice of real corporate due diligence. I mean, I work in the nuclear field, and we track all kinds of illicit trade. And the companies, they're able to, in a sense, look for the needle in the haystack of their exports and pick out the suspicious orders. They have a practice of saying, we really need to know who the end user is. Where in the electronics industry, they just send off millions of components to distributors who could care who the end user is. And so there needs to be some rapid kind of gathering of these electronics manufacturers, the distributors, and then they need to work on policies that would have this idea of due diligence and voluntary constraint, that they just say, look, we're just not going to make these sales of these critical items unless we really know who the end user is.
Okay, let's see what kind of response we do get from the international community.
Yeah, I'm somewhat optimistic. I mean, we'll see how it is when we evaluate imports into Russia, let's say 5 months from now, 6 months from now, and see if some of these measures will start to create bottlenecks in the supply chain for Alabuga's drones.
Well, David Albright, president of the Institute for Science and International Security, speaking to us on the line from Paris. Nice of you to come back onto Flashpoint Iran.
Great. Thank you.
That's all for our program. I'm Michael Lippin. Thanks for listening, and join the team again next week for another Flashpoint Iran.